Hi, everyone. Welcome to JTalks Live, our final show of this season. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, the host of the webcast series and the podcast More. Today, we are discussing the U.S. with all of its polarized politics, the pandemics, the protests over race-related police brutality, and an upcoming presidential election. And at the helm of it all, of course, Donald Trump. My guest today is Susan B. Glasser, staff writer with The New Yorker. She writes a column on Trump's Washington, and she will help shed some insight for us into this chaos. Susan Glasser's award-winning career includes serving as editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy, the founding editor of Politico magazine, and Moscow bureau chief at the Washington Post. But first, the Canadian, before we get to Susan, I just want to say that the CJF, the Canadian Journalism Foundation, would like to thank BMO Financial Group for making this JTalks series possible. And the CJF would also like to thank Cision for its support, as well as CPAC. And I'll give you a few helpful notes for this webcast. If your internet quality is poor, click on the click here to switch stream button on your computer to view at a lower bandwidth. The video quality will decrease when you do that, but the audio should remain the same. If you are having technical issues, you can also click on the request help bubble on the bottom right corner of this webcast page, and your help request will be emailed back to the email address that you have provided. The webcast is 40 minutes long. I will chat with our guests and then take your questions. Many of you have already sent some in, and I've been going through those, and I'll bring in as many as I can. You can submit your questions at any time using the questions tab. And if you want to tweet about this tag, this talk, the hashtag is JTalksLive. So, Susan Glasser, welcome, and let's begin.
Thank you so much, Anna Maria. I'm just delighted to be with you today.
And, you know, I have to say, I've made a list here, you know, in the last week, all of these different issues in the midst of a pandemic, racism laid bare, anger in the streets, unidentifiable police surrounding the White House perimeter. Days ago, Mr. Trump pulled the U.S. out of the WHO. He tried to decree a legal change in a peak of anger over Twitter. Then he ends up in a bunker as unarmed protesters are way outside the White House. Then there's the photo op. Then there are the top military men, including his former defense secretary, who have accused him of violating constitutional rights. Where do we start?
You know, I'm exhausted just listening to that list. Are you you guys in Canada open for journalists seeking refuge?
I'm wondering about your own journalistic whiplash.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it's been often observed, but is nonetheless true for having been much commented on, that these are exhausting times, and that, you know, the sort of Donald Trump as human fog machine, right? There's so many controversies that the fog is simply, you can't remember yesterday's outrage because there are so many new ones today. And that phenomenon, which has been with us for the last few years, has just accelerated. In the last week, remember a week ago when he was at war with Twitter? That seems nostalgic to me, you know, at this point. Last night, after I filed my column, we live here in Washington, about 10 minutes only from downtown Washington. We got in the car, my husband, who's also a journalist, and I, and went down, parked a few blocks away from the White House, a block away from where armed federal troops were guarding the streets, blocking off the streets in a military Humvee. We walked over to the protests in front of the now famous St. John's Church. There were hundreds of, you know, essentially mostly young people, black and white, probably a majority of white citizens. They were being guarded by heavily armed and unidentified personnel. And it was an extraordinary sight for me to see it happening in the United States, having been a foreign correspondent across the former Soviet Union, having been in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just not something I've ever seen here, certainly in the context of the US military or federal troops, essentially confronting people with signs, 21-year-olds with signs. And, you know, there was this line of people at the sort of very front of it. And the young people, they were holding up their phones and they were trying to engage the individual troops. And they were, you know, talking to them and saying, like, you know, when you take off that uniform, you're just one of us. You know, why are you here? What are you doing? Why won't you say who you are? It's un-American. And this one young guy, he started shouting, and I have it on tape. It was so moving to me. He said, you know, it wasn't democratic politicians. It wasn't socialism. It was you. You're the ones who are hurting American democracy. This looks like Venezuela. And you know, I was born in Venezuela, so I can tell you what it looks like there. This doesn't look like America. And it was just a very profound moment to me.
I want to just pick up on the fact that the some of the military personnel or some of the guards around the White House, that perimeter, do not have any identifiable insignias. Do we know who they are? Are they actually police or military, or are they private?
Well, that's correct. I saw it with my own eyes. You know, there were two flanks last night in front of, you know, guarding the square. Now they pushed out the perimeter, so you're no longer even close to the White House. They're essentially taking territory each day away from the public. But so on one side were these big burly guys who looked like paramilitary type troops. They had no identification of any kind. There might be federal prison guard riot police. That unit has been identified as being participating here. No one knew exactly. They would not speak at all to the protesters. On the other side of the square, there were what looked like probably National Guardsmen in combat fatigues from another state. They were much younger. They were much less threatening. They looked like, you know, young men in military uniforms. You know, they were probably weekend warriors from middle America, essentially. And they looked very uncomfortable and much more human, I have to say, than the very threatening. You know, the guys on the other side of the street, they looked like they were in some kind of RoboCop type movie. I mean, you know, it was very dystopian, frankly.
Yeah, you know, and in the last 24 hours or so, we have seen top military people, among them the former Defense Secretary, General Jim Mattis, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, the acting Secretary of the Army, Ryan D. McCarthy, and as well as John Allen, retired general who led fights against ISIS, all making public statements suggesting the president is violating the Constitution and reminding everyone that Americans have the constitutional right to protest. How significant is that criticism coming from generals and retired generals?
Well, you know, I can give you two answers. The answer, you know, in your heart is that you want it to be extremely significant. These are men who have spent decades in service to their country, who have served in a completely nonpartisan way, presidents of both parties, administrations of both parties, who swear their oaths to the Constitution and not to any individual. I know all of the men that you mentioned, with the exception of the acting Secretary of the Army. I've met all of the others. I believe them all to be deeply patriotic and to disagree with each other, by the way. John Allen came out in the 2016 campaign, already a retired general at this time, and endorsed Hillary Clinton, and actually had a big rift with Jim Mattis, who was a very close friend of his and who told him it was the wrong thing to do, and believed that fundamentally that was risking the independence of the military for even a retired general of the stature of John Allen to speak out. So the fact that they're now both on the same side is something very significant and remarkable. However, the flip side is Donald Trump, as you know, has succeeded in part in exposing the hollowness of our institutions and the lack of leadership in the country anymore that has a followership. So I think it also plays right into his narrative that the elites are against me, whether they're the military elites or the business elites or the media elites. So it doesn't necessarily harm him politically in the way you might think. But again, it's a grave moment. And I think people are considering it to be a very grave moment here.
And I should just correct myself. When I said acting secretary, Ryan D. McCarthy is the secretary of the Army. I meant acting in the sense that he's not retired. He's actively
Herman,
in
current.
That role. Yeah, the current member. So there had been some speculation that this is one area that Mr. Trump might actually feel a little bit of he would feel that kind of criticism in a way he hasn't felt the other criticism, but you're suggesting maybe not.
I don't think that, Trump feels anything in and of itself. He has an overriding interest right now in his own political survival. And I believe that that is the dominant and overriding factor in any decision that he's making right now. And so to the extent he thinks it harms him politically, he would take notice of it. And then of course, we've all observed, the core characteristic of Trump, which he himself speaks about, which is his refusal to simply take a punch and move on. If somebody lands a blow on him, he is just an absolute and core believer in punching back, no matter who is making the punch. And so I believe that if anything, it will stiffen his resolve. And again, it's a core belief of Trump that long predates his entry into public life, that demonstrations of strength, as he defines them, which include shows of military might and overwhelming force, even against unarmed protesters, is something that is just wired into him. There's a great column by Nick Kristof today, who 31 years ago today covered the Tiananmen Square massacre for the New York Times in China. And he points out that, of course, the United States and its politicians at the time were united in condemning this, even friends of China like George H.W. Bush. And yet there was one voice in the United States who praised the strong response by Chinese leaders, and that man was Donald Trump 31 years ago.
And today, Mr. Trump was tweeting law and order in capital letters with exclamation marks still. I'm wondering if you see any kind of a weakening of the senators, the Republican senators who have been so quick to support him, given the events of the past week and the number of people on the streets and what we've seen.
So, the overriding story of the Trump era here in Washington is, in fact, his successful takeover of the Republican Party, in particular, the Republican elected officials on Capitol Hill in the Senate, as well as the House of Representatives. And of course, these same senators spoke with a unanimous voice just a few months ago in voting to acquit Donald Trump in the Senate trial, with the lone exception of Mitt Romney. However, this morning, you had a very interesting comment from Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who was one of the senators who was seen as on the fence in that Senate impeachment trial. She ultimately voted not only not to have any witnesses in that trial, making it questionable as to what kind of a trial it was, but also voted to acquit Trump this morning. She said, well, General Mattis spoke for me, and he really aired concerns that I think we all have to share and take seriously, and strongly suggested she was considering coming out against Trump's reelection and basically endorsing this remarkable comments from General Mattis of yesterday, in which he essentially compared Donald Trump, the man he served as defense secretary with the Nazis, and said it was un-American what he had done on Monday night. So that was a remarkable statement by Lisa Murkowski. We'll see if she follows through. A very small number of other Republican senators have questioned it. But again, the story is, I would say, the acquiescence of the whole, much more so than it is the dissent of a small handful, at least for now. They've made their political bet, it may not be paying off for them, but it would be very, very hard for them to switch gears at this point unless they felt their own existential threat, survival was at stake.
You've described the president as a super spreader of distraction, and you've labeled some of what he's been doing and saying and tweeting as his own Operation Obfuscation. How much of what we're seeing now is part of that deliberate effort to keep diverting attention or to confuse?
Well, it's very interesting, right? You know, for the last 2.5-3 months, Donald Trump has wanted to change the subject desperately from the coronavirus pandemic and his own botched handling of it, right? And he, of course, you know, denied that it was coming to the United States. Then he said it was going to go to zero. Then he said it was going to go away in the warm weather. Then he said there would only be a few people who would die of it. And then he said, never mind, let's just reopen. And so he has been really eager to change the subject and to create other controversies. I'm not sure that a massive national protest movement against racial violence was the distraction he had in mind. And what I've been struck by actually just the last couple of days, it's early yet, but if you look at some of the early polls, his remarks, even from Republicans on handling race relations, are even worse than they were on the coronavirus. So this might be the one distraction, that is even more politically damaging to him than the other distractions he threw up. So I'm not sure this is what he had in mind, frankly.
Yeah, and we've noticed that he said so very little about the whole issue of race and what is really playing out on the streets and what that is emblematic of. He made a comment, what was it, 2 days ago? I can't remember, everything happened so fast, but that MAGA loves Black people. He said almost nothing to the kind of pain that we are seeing, in the manifestations of these protests. Talk to me a little bit about how that, how you're reading that, how you're watching that.
Well, look, again, to draw the through line from the pandemic to the sort of political unrest that we're seeing right now in the United States, empathy is just not part of brand Trump. It's not who he is as a person. And you're never going to hear it from him, whether it's about 100,000 Americans dying in a short period of time, or it's about the agony of police brutality and unjust racism in America. It's just not who he is, and you're never gonna hear that. And if you did, it wouldn't be genuine. And he understands that on some level. So part of it is his own calculation and understanding that it worried to say that. But it's even more than that, that Donald Trump has continually both inflamed racial tensions in the United States and actually profited from them. Remember that, that's the original sin of the Trump political persona, was him essentially making racially tinged comments about Barack Obama and, suggesting that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, which is essentially a racist conspiracy theory that he and others advanced with obviously no basis in fact. And that is the entire basis of his public persona and political appeal. So Donald Trump isn't going to abandon the racism that got him into the White House, number one.
We have seen him obsessed with Barack Obama for quite a while now.
What's so remarkable for a man who is, has that at the core of his political identity, just yesterday he tweeted from the White House while surrounded by these and protected by these massively armed federal troops. He tweeted from the White House that he has done more for African Americans than any president in U.S. history, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln. That's a direct quote.
So is he completely delusional, or does he think this boosts him among a certain demographic of supporters?
Right. So, pretty clearly, he's not actually aiming for Black votes there. The African-American community has consistently actually been the strongest demographic group against Donald Trump. And I think, we're talking like over 90%, identifying as Democratic at this point. So why is he saying comments like that? Donald Trump has a terrible problem with suburban white voters, in particular suburban white women voters, and he will not win re-election, even with our electoral map of the states favoring Republicans. He will not win re-election unless he can keep enough of those white suburban voters who don't consider themselves to be racist and aren't particularly desiring of having a president, even of their own party, who is so explicitly identified as one. So I believe that, you know, those comments throughout his presidency, actually, about African Americans are aimed probably at a certain segment of white voters and trying to persuade them that it's okay to vote for him.
And you actually, in a big feature in The New Yorker, actually followed a Never Trumper Republican, who a woman who's been really trying to parse some of that and really pull out those votes that were Trump that can be shifted. Kind of making the point that you don't need all Trump supporters to shift. You just need some you need some laser focus, or they believe they need some laser focus to shift those votes.
Well, that's right. It's very interesting. So, you know, that's one theory of the case, right? That Donald Trump, remember, he won election in 2016 in a big upset where he actually lost the American popular vote, but he won the Electoral College because of just three states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And these are essentially industrial Rust Belt states of the, you know, Midwest, or where a certain number of moderate suburban Republican votes were essentially the key to the outcome. And so this piece that I wrote was looking at a lifetime Republican strategist and activist who is very anti-Trump and, you know, mostly has experienced the last few years as a series of almost horrifying out-of-body experiences where she's losing and losing and losing and realizing that the people that she worked with and was friends with for years were not who she thought, and have one by one made accommodations to Trump. And that's what people do, you know, in Washington or in any capital city in Canada as well. They make accommodation to power. And yet realizing that voters didn't necessarily make those same calculations. And she's been doing intensive focus groups with mostly women who identify as Republicans, who admit that they were Trump voters in 2016, but are varying degrees of uncertain. And I listened in on those. And, you know, what I found is that they really, really don't like Donald Trump, but they weren't very interested in the Democratic Party either. And so, you know, that made them an up for grabs group of people.
How do you interpret Joe Biden's message and in the last couple of days as well?
Well, I think, again, you know, you would think that Donald Trump has offered more material for any politician to work with than one could possibly imagine. I do think that, you know, Biden and his team seem to understand and seem to have a clear theory of the case that as long as the election is a referendum on Donald Trump and his incumbency, they're likely to win. If Trump succeeds in changing the subject or making it more about Biden, it would be more competitive. So, you know, essentially Biden has tried to remain focused on, you know, he's a healer, he's a uniter, not a divider. This is not the America we live in. You know, it's a choice that America faces, America or Trump. And, you know, that's the message right now. It's very pretty clear.
And I will ask you more about election because we have a lot of those questions coming in, but I'll just ask, before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that Mr. Trump has done. And again, in the last couple of days, that, like, pulling the United States of the WHO, canceling the G7, inviting Mr. Putin not only to join the group of G7, which would make it G8 again, but also inviting him to the States. Through your prism as a former foreign correspondent in the former Soviet republics, what are you thinking?
Well, again, you know, one of the enduring and troubling mysteries of the Trump era is his extreme fascination with Vladimir Putin and obsession with bringing close ties to him personally, as well as on a policy level. It's something that is essentially not supported by American leaders, politicians of either party, Republicans as well as Democrats, you know, pretty much disagree with Donald Trump about this. And yet he has what seems to be almost a personal fascination with Vladimir Putin. And again, the through line of many of the controversies of the Trump era go back to Vladimir Putin, Trump's insistence back in the campaign in 2016 of praising Putin, contrasting his leadership favorably with that of Barack Obama, insisting that he would consider rolling back sanctions, which is an issue that was what was discussed in the controversial phone call between Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, and the former Russian ambassador to the United States, the call that led to Flynn's firing led him to plead guilty, and now is somehow been reinvented by Trump as an example of Flynn's persecution. So that was all about Putin and sanctions, which is why I bring it up now. And yet here you have once again, even though the Congress of the United States, Republicans, have passed a law saying, you know, Donald Trump doesn't have the right to get rid of those sanctions, just like Donald Trump does not actually have the right to unilaterally reinvite Vladimir Putin to the G7. He was thrown out of the G7 for invading Crimea, which he still holds. Even Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Great Britain and an ally of Trump, came out very quickly and said, you know, we would veto that. We're not in favor of that. Canada as well. And so why is Donald Trump risking political capital both domestically and internationally on behalf of Vladimir Putin in the middle of the election year? I pose it as a question because it remains a question without an answer.
It's almost as if, as we watch Mr. Trump and the many things he has said and how he conducts himself, it's almost as if there is even more of a spiral happening right now. I don't know if I'm right about that he seems to be almost like staggering from pillar to post in how he's approaching everything.
Well, it's interesting that even given the level of kind of self-created controversies the last few years, you now have the combination of Trump's continued penchant to create controversy colliding with actual externally imposed crises that were not of his making, which largely he escaped in his first few years in office. So that combination, I think, has led things to feel like they are teetering, on the brink even more so than they have been. It does feel like a particularly unhinged moment in American politics, doesn't it?
What did you call it? It's a mix of the menacing and the absurd.
Well, there is that too, yes. Yeah. You know, if you go back and read, you know, the great literature of, you know, Eastern Europe during Soviet domination, or, you know, other people living through moments of dictatorship and tyranny, you forget that a lot of the great narratives there are about the absurdity and ridiculousness of strongmen, as well as their menacing. And that's just a quality that Trump has in spades. He's a pretty absurdist character.
I want to go to some of the questions. So there's a question from Jim Brody who asks, what is Trump's kryptonite? What types of stories will finally shock his base into seeing him for who he is and who they've enabled?
Well, so those are almost two different questions. It's a great question. One is, what's his personal kryptonite? And then the other is, what would actually harm him with his political base and cause these followers of his to break away? I think on the personal level, one is easier to answer. Trump clearly, has a lot of issues, as they say. and in a way, we've all become armchair Trumpologists or, shrinks in the last few years, as he seems to be sort of inflicting his own personal drama and troubles on the nation and the world writ large. Who knows what's really inside that head? But one thing that does trigger Donald Trump is personal criticism that gets to him and his father. Clearly, his father was a dominant personality who shaped him in some what appears to be highly negative way. Certainly I've talked to those who have made it their mission to get inside Trump's head, and they think that the key is to talk about his daddy issues and to raise the disapproval of his father at every turn on a personal level. he just in general cannot handle a certain kind of criticism. It makes him absolutely lash out in ways that tend to be not to his own benefit. As far as his followers, what's remarkable is that even though you may be reading a lot of coverage right now about how Trump is losing in the polls and, you know, Biden has had a pretty consistent lead and now that seems to be opening up even a little bit, I would say read those with a caveat. The caveat is this: essentially, he still has a poll I just looked at this morning, about a 40% national approval rating. That's exactly the same approval rating that he had in January, before the pandemic, before the greatest economic collapse since the Great Depression, before national protests that have resulted in the biggest wave of violence since 1968. So nothing will shake these people. There's almost nothing, it appears, that Donald Trump can't do and have almost 40% of the American public still approving of him.
And of course, that speaks to the fact that there is no clear, there's, you know, anyone who thinks the Democrats have a cakewalk, it's just not true in the coming election. But given the way things are going, is it even a certainty that the November elections will proceed?
Well, this is a good question. And it's a question that many Americans, have started to get jittery and wonder about. Actually, Time magazine recently asked Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who also works in the White House, this question. And he said, well, there's nothing that we're considering at this time that would change that date. Now, I would just remind listeners that the Constitution of the United States prescribes the date, time, and manner of the general election in this country. And I believe that is an unwavering date. Now, what are the conditions under which we're going to be voting? Those vary widely from state and locality. It is under the control of different state officials. And as you know, there are already many troubles that predate Donald Trump when it comes to having equal access to voting and, making sure that those conditions for a free and fair vote exist. And in the coronavirus context, making sure that there's access to mail-in ballots for those who need them, is something that already has become politicized. Trump has already been suggesting that the election is going to be rigged, which is something that he did in 2016 as well when he thought he was going to lose. And so I think it's going to be a very, very contentious process by which we vote, but I don't have any question that we will be voting in November.
And as I say, there are lots of questions. Canadians are, both fascinated and on edge watching all of this unfold. David Ellenbass asks, what happens when, and I'll say when and if, or when, but what happens when Trump loses in November and refuses to accept the result? How is the constitutional crisis resolved?
Well, again, obviously we're living in a moment when many once previously unthinkable things are occurring. So I don't rule anything out, but I have to say this has been a scenario ever since, Trump was elected. People have talked about this question saying, well, he'll never leave willingly. I do believe that if he loses and he is certified to have done so, and the Constitution, again, stipulates a process by which the electors, remember, we don't have a national popular vote. We vote, and then each state has electors who then are named, who become the Electoral College, and they meet before the end of this year. If the Electoral College has met and certified that Donald Trump has lost, then he's out. And I don't believe there's anything he can do. Now, the scarier scenario, of course, is an uncertain election result. Let's say it's very close on election night, and then there are millions of uncounted mailed-in ballots and absentee ballots, and he questions the legitimacy of those. That's where things are up in the air. But I think, once we have a certified election result, the entire machinery of the U.S. government from that point forward just is not in his hands.
There's a question from Adam Plackett related to that. There's currently a case before the Supreme Court, which will determine whether Electoral College voters have to vote for whichever candidate won the majority of votes in their state. I don't understand how this issue has got as far as the Supreme Court, as it would make a mockery of the whole presidential election if they were able to vote for the losing candidate. Can you explain?
Well, again, we just do not have a straightforward, direct democracy system here in the United States. And many states already do have laws. I forget the current number, but a large number of states already have laws that in effect bind their electors to follow the election results, the popular election results in their states. But it's not a requirement. And once it's there, it's there. And by the way, if there is a tie in the Electoral College, then it goes to the House of Representatives, where they are not under any obligations connected with the popular vote. Although interestingly, this happened only once before in our history in 1876. But it doesn't just go to the House of Representatives, and each member of the House of Representatives gets a vote. It goes by state delegations. Well, right now, of the current Congress, right now, Democrats hold the majority in the House of Representatives. However, they do not hold the majority. I think it's only by like one state of the state delegations. So it's quite possible. Again, I don't think this will happen, but just so people understand the process, that's how it works.
Esther Ankin sends a question. How would you assess the structural and systemic damage Mr. Trump will leave behind, even if he's defeated? Seems like so many institutions of democracy are undermined.
Well, as you might imagine, this is a question that, lots of people are asking themselves. And I do think there would be an enormous difference between a one-term Trump presidency and a two-term Trump presidency in terms of lasting changes in trajectory or, fundamental disrupting of our institutions. However, the challenging and shattering of norms, the fact that so many of the things that we thought were core tenets of our democracy turn out to be actually norms rather than rules or laws that are encoded into permanent behavior means that surely he will have left his mark on Washington, even if a new president comes in and tries to undo much of what he's done. For example, the long trajectory of the last few decades in both parties holding the White House has been toward increasing executive authority. A future president may justify some of what Trump is doing on the basis that, well, I'm using these powers toward good ends and not toward bad ends. So some of the powers may be hard to undo. The assault on the press, as you know, it's not just Republicans who like to blame the messenger, even though we've certainly never had any president of any party who has attacked the media in such a sustained and calculated way. We've never had a president who called the press the enemies of the people. But with that stipulation, there are certainly scenarios you can imagine where leaders, a Democratic president would also want to leave in place some of the lack of transparency in the executive agencies, for example, that Trump has pursued.
I've got another question here. It looks like we're almost out of time, but this might be the place to end. And this is about the wider racism issue that the United States is being reminded of with all of these protests. This comes from Patricia Deverell. Emancipation never really happened in America. The murder of George Floyd was a modern day lynching. The only difference between historical and present day abuses is that racism is now seen more. Why has the United States never undergone a Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, it's a powerful question, and it's a powerful and sad moment of reckoning in the country. Barack Obama gave a very interesting address yesterday talking about some of these issues, and he made the argument that there is something different, that unlike the protests in the 1960s, that this is a much more broad-based and diverse movement supporting Black people in America today. I certainly have seen in the protests that I've observed here in Washington, D.C., a large outpouring of support for African Americans from white people, from brown people, and that this is not the 1968 of Donald Trump's, divisive imagining, in many ways. Our cities have changed. And I think that's why there is this outrage and this uproar over not just George Floyd's killing, but, a spate of killings in recent years, and a sense that the balance of power is skewed in the wrong direction in our cities and with our police departments in ways that have to be corrected. Now, Barack Obama, is of course an optimist at heart, as he often used to say, you got to be an optimist if a kid like me can grow up to be the president of the United States of America. And all I would say is that, each generation has to, not take it as settled fact. It's write their own version of this. It's shocking on the one hand that a big headline in the news yesterday was Virginia Governor Ralph Northam says he's going to take down the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia, the capital. You could say, how the heck did it take this long for that to happen? Or you could say, well, good, finally, at last. So, I do think that, we won't know until it's over how we did, as in our moment in time. But, as horrifying and shocking as it's been as a U.S. citizen to look at our own military blocking young people from their First Amendment rights the last few days, the flip side is, to see so many people across the country protesting who never did before, you could also count that as a sign of progress.
So much work for you to do in your coverage of Washington and the Trump administration and Trump himself. Susan, thanks for your insights and for all the work you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for all these questions. And please save a place for us in Canada.
Well, the border is still mostly closed and people want to know when that's going to change too, or what the U.S. will do with it. But we'll save that for another day. Thank you again, Susan.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone for sending your questions. That is it for this season of JTalks. We're really glad you've joined us for these conversations featuring journalists who are covering angles of COVID and its impact. We hope we're able to shed some light on the new reality and the changing reality. There's so many tentacles to this, even more than when it first began. If you missed any webcasts, they are all available to view on CJF's website. The JTalks season is over, but there's still one webcast left, and it's a special one. The Canadian Journalism Foundation invites you to join a celebration of journalistic excellence with its virtual CJF Award Ceremony next Thursday, June 11th. Rick Mercer will host this special online event. CTV's Lisa Laflamme will present the awards. You can watch at 1 o'clock Eastern Time or the rebroadcast the same evening at 7 p.m. and view the details and register for the virtual ceremony on the CJF website. We hope you will join us. Thank you for watching. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Bye-bye.